Hey, good morning, everyone. It's Dave Weiner here, and it is Monday, November 25th, 2013, the week of Thanksgiving. And I was just ranting over on Facebook. It was, I don't know what got me started. It was a piece that was in NJ.com, and it was pointed to by my very good friend Zachary Tooman. And he pointed to it on Facebook, and he said, it says that turns out New York Penn Station handles 650,000 rail passengers daily, which is twice what Hartsfield Atlanta Airport handles, and it's greater than LaGuardia, JFK, and Newark airports combined. Now, and they had an article in there about the Network Ops Center at Penn Station. And of course, this gets you going, right? Because what is it? I mean, Penn Station is the landmark that is no longer there. It was, you know, the story goes like this, that it was the most beautiful train station anywhere. I mean, I'm sure they exaggerate. There are some pretty beautiful train stations in the world. But apparently it was pretty magnificent, and it, I never saw it because it was torn down before, I guess it was torn down before I was born. When was it torn down? Let's see if we can figure this out. So yeah, I'm looking at the article for on Wikipedia. No, actually, it was not torn down before I was born. It was torn down in, well, it existed in 1962. They have a picture here of the, sorry, I'm at the biography for Ada Louise Huxtable, and this is on Wikipedia, and they have a picture of the concourse in 1962 of Penn Station 2 years before demolition. So it was demolished in 1964. And there's a quote, "Not that Penn Station is the Parthenon," Ada Louise Huxtable wrote, "but it might as well be because we can never afford a 9-acre structure of superbly detailed travertine any more than we could build one of solid gold. It is a monument to the lost art of magnificent construction, comma, other values aside." This was written by the architecture critic at the New York Times, Ada Louise Huxtable, who turns out died just this year, in January of this year. This fight was going on in the 60s, in the early to mid-60s, and it was the turning point for the city of New York, of us not destroying the city of New York. As weird as it may seem, we were, after World War II, there was this whole movement called Urban Renewal, and it was, I guess the United States was felt left out because our cities were not getting rebuilt from the ground up because they weren't destroyed in World War II like the, you know, European and Asian cities were. America was unique in that our cities survived the war intact without any damage at all. That didn't stop us. We tore down huge swaths of city, and we were about to do a lot more of it. Some of it was the belief that cities were not constructed rationally, that they were allowed to grow in a random fashion, and that planners and architects could build us better cities that worked better. It turns out they were wrong. We did the experiment here, and what we got were projects. And projects were like tall apartment buildings with lots of space between them and no neighborhood feel to them. No, you know, stores on the corner, no meeting places for people to hang out. And it was dangerous because, you know, you had to walk through. So people stayed in their houses and they were turned into war zones. And I mean, all kinds of nasty stuff happened that was undone when we started rebuilding our neighborhoods in New York. The other thing that was happening was the transition to the automobile, and they were cutting down big pieces of the city just to create highways. Like, and the classic example of that was the Cross Bronx Expressway, that, you know, at least in Queens and out on Long Island, they were building freeways out to places that people didn't live. They were just farmland, but in the Bronx, there were people there, and they basically just cut a huge, and it destroyed the borough. It turned into a hellhole, and I know that from firsthand experience because I went to high school in the Bronx in the late 60s, early 70s, when it was falling apart and when it was burning down. And, you know, the whole city was in terrible shape then. But the turning point was the destruction of Penn Station to create whatever you think of Madison Square Garden. I mean, and the Knicks and the Dolans, and you know, it was not whatever it was. It didn't turn out to be a happy thing. I guess we like going to basketball games and concerts there, but turns out the train station was pretty important too. And could we not have had both those things? Yeah, of course we could have, but we were in the mode of destroying things. Now, the point of this podcast, why is this relevant to, you know, people who read Scripting News, my blog, and the answer is that, well, first of all, anytime we are tearing things down and for purposes of technology, because some new technology came along, it's always important. You know, we always equate changing the world with making the world better, but a lot of times that mentality has led to real bad things happening. And so changing the world is not necessarily a good thing. Being thoughtful about doing these things and deciding, well, what do we value, what don't we value, and actually using our minds when we do this, and our hearts too. You know, what do we love about the places we live? Well, there was a good lot of reasons apparently to love Penn Station. And what the Times did there, and Ada Louise Huxtable was a columnist, architecture critic for the New York Times, she took a leadership position and a discussion, which is otherwise known as politics, gathered up around this cause. And that was the end of urban renewal in New York, or the beginning of the end. There was also Jane Jacobs. That was another chapter that was, she was going up against Robert Moses, was another force for this. I'm not sure that Moses was probably behind the destruction of Penn Station, too. It was his thing. Anyway, the point being is that the Times can be, a newspaper can be, have meaning for the community that exists within. And the Times doesn't seem to do that anymore. It is unthinkable to imagine the Times having empowering, although there has actually been an example of this recently with Nick Bilton, who is a technology blogger or reporter at the Times. I'm not sure which they call him now. Probably both would be my guess. Is that he decided to ask the question about, why do we have to turn off our devices, our Kindles and our iPods and so forth, our cell phones even, as the plane is taking off and leaving. And that just was completely overturned this year. And now all of a sudden you can, I mean, it's great. And there's no question that he played a role in doing that. And that was a good thing. Of course, if some planes start crashing, well, nobody, we don't believe it's going to happen. But if some planes were to start crashing, I suppose that would be a problem. But we don't think that's going to happen, right? So look at other, now that was, I think it's a small thing, to be honest with you. I mean, obviously, socially, it's meaningful because it's a victory against idiocracy, I mean, or bureaucracy or whatever. Just sort of the lack of, I really don't think it was a big deal. I mean, you know, you get back a few minutes on either end. It's a symbolic victory. And maybe it's a sign that we can do things more consciously and more intelligently, you know. Because that was a pretty good symbol of us not being either conscious or intelligent. That leads me to I live in New York City. I live in Manhattan. And I love living here. It's phenomenal. If you feel like you're in the middle of the world, of the universe, of everything. And it's a nice feeling. And there's never a lack of, it's a good place to live for, you know, Thing is, though, the internet connectivity here is awful, and it could be really good, and it could be that now that we've saved the city from urban renewal, maybe it's time to start thinking about the city in ways in which we can grow it. And now we've got some good examples of that too that we've done recently, the bike paths and the city bike program, and these are really good things for a city. It's a very good place. Very good thing for a city to be doing. If we weren't doing it, we'd be saying, well, you know, we're really missing the boat. But the opposite is happening. The city really embraces it, and it's a great thing. But let's also do the internet here. Let's also get internet connectivity working really well. And it just, it pisses me off that the Times thinks, when they think of the internet, they think of a problem. They think of something that's hurting them, that's erasing their business model. And when you look at things that way, that's what happens. It does erase your business model. If you see it as a threat, then you will experience it as a threat. But this is one of those places where if you just turn your mind around, it is actually going to change its effect on you. If instead you say, okay, well, the internet is the best thing that has ever happened for news in a city. It's the best thing, and we're totally excited about all the different ways this can improve the quality of life, because it improves communication, because it improves community, because it improves politics, because it can involve more people. Maybe we can make more intelligent decisions by involving more of the resources of the city in the intellect of the city. Yet the Times has not embraced this. In fact, it's held on, really, it's the holding on that's causing them problems, because they hold on to the idea that writing or contributing to the discourse of whatever it is that they cover is something that needs to be exclusive, that it needs to be who you know and who you hang out with and who you're friends with that determines whether or not your ideas get heard. And that creates a small funnel for a place as big as a city. And the city can grow around outside of that, and it will, and it is, doing that. And to the extent that it does that, it will marginalize the New York Times and any other institution that does not grow in the same direction that this discourse does grow. It could be that, we'll just leave it there. I mean, this is the way change happens. Either you go with it and grow with it and take the risks that come with doing that, or you end up, you know, being on the sidelines and not participating in the growth. You can't have the growth if you don't take the risks. And there was a time, the point being is that if you look at the Ada Louise Huxtable story, there was a time when the Times felt, when people who wrote for the Times and presumably the management of the Times didn't get in the way of it, that they had a stake in the community that they exist within, and that there are times when you roll up your sleeves and you become part of the cause, not just somebody on the sidelines that's writing about what's happening. You actually get involved in what's happening, and you make change happen. It's okay for a newspaper that's called the New York Times to have that conflict of interest, that they are, that they have an interest in the success of the thing called New York. There's no problem with that. The San Jose Mercury News, they can't be the San Jose Mercury News and not be in favor of San Jose. They should do something else if they're not. Somebody has to be. That's their conflict. So the Times should love New York because it's called the New York Times. And that means that it's okay for them to be a force for either change or for no change. You see, it's not necessarily true that some things we want to change that would be really good to change, like having all the connectivity that can come from the great communication systems that we have. On the other hand, there's other change that we don't want to have. We don't want to tear down our great landmarks because we want to know where we came from. We want the ideas that we create to not be torn down by the next generation. This is another thing. It's like, if you're tearing everything down, then what can you hope to be creating with your life? Is there anything other than just breathing in and out and eating and defecating to life? Is there anything more to it? Do you create anything other than that? Well, if we're tearing down everything that we create, the answer is no. The answer is, why even bother being alive, you know? I mean, there are obviously other benefits from being alive, and I don't want to drift too much. But there's this involvement that I don't feel that any of the news organizations, and it's not just the Times. I mean, the Times, though, is the shining example of it, mostly for its past, I think. But it's true of all news organizations, and it's also true of none of them, because these days they are not doing that. So anyway, Ada Louise Huxtable, God bless you. And Penn Station, really, we do miss you, even though we don't know what we're missing. So that's it. That's my podcast for today. Hope you're all doing great. Bye-bye.